You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Federal Reserve lowered interest rates last week. Coming up, we find out how financial moves by the Fed could affect Wisconsin borrowers, including people who own property or are considering buying a home. That conversation is just ahead. Now on Wisconsin Today, as the Federal Reserve hands down a large interest rate cut, the first time since the start of the pandemic, how will it affect Wisconsin borrowers?
Also, with a housing shortage in Wisconsin, will the rate cut affect housing supply and demand around the state?
To explore these questions, we turn to residential mortgage specialist Laura Stanfield at Wintrust Mortgage in Madison. Laura, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, the Federal Reserve influences mortgage rates, but it doesn't set them. Can you explain the connection here? How does the central bank affect mortgage rates?
Yeah, so the federal funds rate is the topic of conversation right now. That's what we hear in the news about whether the Fed is going to lower it, hopefully not raise it anymore. But that is the rate at which banks lend money to each other, basically. So that is kind of like the base cost for all kinds of loans, really. It could be credit cards, could be mortgages, home equity lines of credit. So it's really the rate at which funds are lent out to banks so that they can then lend money to consumers.
Laura, do you anticipate loan demand will pick up?
Yeah, I do. This has been the topic of conversation ever since 2020 and all that we've dealt with COVID and all the residual economic effects from COVID. So the Fed had to slow down spending, and that's why the federal funds rate just continued to increase. And so this has been the topic for the last several years, I'd say, but it's really had an impact on the housing market in the last couple years, for sure. They got as high as mortgage rates, not the federal funds rate, but mortgage rates got as high as 8%. So that's quite a shock for people in the market to buy a home. And it's also a shock for people who might be thinking about selling their home, but maybe they were able to lock in at the lowest rates we've ever seen at 2 or 3% when we were going through, COVID. There's a lot of people that were able to take advantage of those lowest of lows. So it's really hard to get rid of that, to let that go when rates are in the 7 or 8% if you're going to be buying a new home after you sell your current home. So it's really stalled the housing market over the last couple of years. And I hope that this will kind of reinvigorate it again a bit.
I want to look at the COVID pandemic. Market Watch says 14 million mortgages were refinanced during the pandemic at record low rates below 3%, as you mentioned. So as mortgage rates fall, would this affect Wisconsinites who refinanced during this historic rate plunge?
Yeah, well, I think we're still going to be, for a lot of people, in that mindset that it's just hard to let go of 2 or 3%. Mm. So some people have decided that they're just going to stay. They're not going to sell when they normally would have. It could be a lot of reasons. It could be families growing and they need more space. And so they want to sell and buy something a little bit bigger. Or it could be people, you know, aging and I really don't need all the space and they want to downsize. But do I want to start over with a new mortgage if it's going to be, you know, maybe three times what my current rate is? So I think it's a financial conundrum, but it's also a psychological one in the sense that I think people just really have to get their heads around, how does this impact me and what would my mortgage payment look like? But people are also sitting on, in most cases, a lot of equity because we've seen home prices increase quite a bit. And so, you know, possibly they could take a lot of money out of the equity from the sale of their home, net proceeds, and put it toward a new one and keep their mortgage payment low, just because they don't need to finance as much. And then now we're in a situation where we're 2% lower than the highs that we've seen in the last 2 years. So I think that just becomes more palatable for people if we're in the 5% range or 6%.
Laura Stanfield with us, residential mortgage specialist at Wintrust Mortgage in Madison, as we talk about the Fed's sizable half-point rate cut and how it could affect our economy and borrowing costs here in Wisconsin. We've had this affordable housing crunch, and I'm wondering, will this rate cut have any effect on our affordable housing shortage?
That's an excellent question. So just by nature of rates dropping back by 2%, that could be a pretty good chunk in your monthly payment. It really does depend on your loan amount, how much you're financing. So obviously the higher the loan amount, the more the difference, positive difference it would make in your monthly payment. But, you know, is it enough? I don't know. Every situation is so individual and specific. So when I'm talking to buyers about this, or possibly home sellers who would turn into home buyers again, I'm just trying to get people in the mindset to be curious. So it might not impact you in the way that you think it will. It might, I don't know, but let's just find out. Let's just run numbers and see what your payment might look like. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can decide as a consumer if you feel like that's a comfortable payment for you to handle, if it's affordable or not.
We've also been hearing that banks have been lowering their rates on mortgages for some time, anticipating this rate cut, kind of baking it in. How much of a difference will this half a percentage point make now that it's real?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you said that, because on the one hand, when things change in our world, I think it's just kind of human nature and psychology involved, but it takes a while for people to get the information and then to absorb it and then to apply it to their own situation. So we don't always see people reacting right away when something like this happens, because it just takes a bit to hear about it, to talk about it, to, you know, hear family and friends and coworkers say, hey, did you hear about the rate cut? Or you hear it on the news, but you don't know how it impacts you. But yes, you are 100% right. A lot of people don't know that the market itself, the 10-year treasury note really is what's going to determine first mortgage rates. It's mortgage-backed bonds that determine first mortgage rates. The federal funds rate is kind of like an indirect impact to first mortgage rates. So it was already, like you said, baked in. Mm-hmm. So the market already assumed that there was going to be a rate cut coming. And we assumed at least 25%, hopefully, you know, 50, and we got it. But it really was already presumed that a rate cut would be coming. And so the market had already positively reacted to that. Mm. So we had already seen rates come down. And then when the Fed meeting happened and we got confirmation that it was a half a percent lower, that didn't really have a big impact, honestly. We really didn't see a lot of movement at all in first mortgage rates because it was already factored in. Yeah. But there's another rate cut coming, you know, we hope in November.
So I was going to ask you that, like, you know, do you anticipate, you know, momentum here, additional cuts by the end of the year?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I don't have that much power, obviously, but based on the numbers that we're looking at, and that's really what it's all about. What do unemployment numbers look like? What do consumer confidence, you know, numbers look like? Are people out there spending money? Are they spending a little bit too much? And inflation is rising. They're trying to bring inflation numbers down, and they are coming down without a doubt. So as long as those numbers keep coming down, then I think they will be motivated to keep bringing the federal funds rate down. But they've said that they're going to do it slowly. They're calling it a soft landing. So they want us to come back down to a level that they feel like is reasonable, but they want it to be soft and they want it to be gradual. So I do think we're going to see another one. I don't think that's just wishful thinking. It's really based on numbers. And then we should see more anticipation of that in the numbers and in the actual mortgage rates in advance of the actual meeting and the decision.
One other thing I want to get your take on that, you know, we've seen it being more expensive for large home builders to start new projects, to start new apartment buildings. Do you expect this interest rate cut to help housing starts?
Oh, I hope so. As far as housing starts, though, go, and if we're talking about developers and builders, my thought is that we really need to see some change on the side of the municipalities, making it easier and more affordable, to just kind of, get the process started. So that's really the land costs, the acquisition costs for just land, development costs, zoning issues, permits, all the things that have to happen prior to even being able to break ground and start building a home. So there's a lot of things in my opinion that need to start at the city municipality level to make it easier for builders to come in and start building more affordable housing.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Of course, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Laura Stanfield is a residential mortgage specialist at Wintrust Mortgage in Madison, as we've been talking about how the Fed's interest rate cut could affect Wisconsinites. Now, Breast Cancer Awareness Month kicks off next week. An estimated 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer in her lifetime. And breast cancer is becoming more common among young women.
Major risk factors for breast cancer include age, family history, breast density, and the presence of benign breast conditions like cysts.
But there are also risk factors for breast cancer that you can control, like alcohol consumption and hormone use.
Dr. Leah Dietrich joins us now for a look at detection, prevention, and treatment. Dr. Dietrich is a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer care and prevention at Gunderson Health System. Dr. Dietrich, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, Dr. Dietrich, I understand that you yourself are a breast cancer survivor. If you're willing, can you share that experience with us?
Yeah, I sure can. I'm a 13-year survivor. So I was diagnosed when I was 42, had elementary and middle school-aged kids. And being a breast cancer doctor, I think it was good and bad. The good things that can happen and the bad things that can happen. I'd also seen my sister go through a breast cancer diagnosis, so I had a family history and was very vigilant about my screening and paying attention to my breast health.
Now, in general, we hear about things like risk factors for breast cancer, one of the more common forms of cancer, of course, for women. When we say risk factors, what kind of things are we talking about?
So there's a lot of different risk factors for breast cancer, and some of those things you can control and some of those things you can't control. So, for instance, things that you can't control, being a woman. 99% of people with breast cancer are women. You can't control your family history. But then there are some things that you can control. And those are obviously the things that we like to focus on with people when we talk about breast cancer prevention.
Right. What are some of those lifestyle things and other risk factors that we do have some control over?
So most breast cancers are related to estrogen. And so different types of exposure to estrogen over a lifetime can affect your risk for breast cancer. So one of the things that is protective is having children and breastfeeding. And then other lifestyle type things is getting to an ideal weight and maintaining it. We know that for postmenopausal women, which is the most common age at diagnosis for breast cancer, being overweight is a risk factor for breast cancer. So that's one thing that people can do. The other lifestyle thing is being active. We know that increased physical activity is tied to a decreased risk of breast cancer. And then another lifestyle thing is alcohol. More and more studies are coming out correlating alcohol and a lot of different types of cancers. There is a risk with alcohol use, even as little as 3 drinks a week for women is associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. And the more alcohol you drink, the higher that risk goes.
Looking longer term, what do you see when it comes to trends with breast cancer? I hear different reports over the years, but it seems like, especially for younger women, we're seeing some increases in breast cancer. What are some of the long-term things you've been watching?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the average age of breast cancer diagnosis is in the low 60s. But what we have been seeing is that the incidence of breast cancer is going up for all women, but it is going up more sharply for younger women. So that's obviously not a trend that we want to see happening. The good news is that we continue to decrease the rate of death related to breast cancer. So fewer women are dying of breast cancer, even though more women are being diagnosed.
Well, I want to dig into each of those things. Let's start with that second point that fewer women are dying of breast cancer, even though we're detecting it more often. Is it what's driving that? Are we detecting it earlier? Are we developing new treatments? What kind of things are helping there?
Yeah, so if we look over many years, screening mammography was a huge influence in decreasing the mortality rate related to breast cancer because earlier diagnosis means a better prognosis. And so getting screening mammograms is very important. The other thing that has spurred that is better treatments. So we're able to cure breast cancer more commonly, more often, because of new medicines that we have to treat breast cancer.
And then with the increase in breast cancer diagnosis, I could see a couple things happening. Maybe we're screening more, so we're finding more cases, or maybe there's some sort of, I don't know, environmental or lifestyle change or something else going on that actually is increasing the incidence of breast cancer. What do we know? What questions are there still?
Yeah, those are some big questions that we're trying to answer. We know that there's an obesity epidemic. We know that that is related to breast cancer diagnosis. But there's also studies going on looking at different types of diets that could influence breast cancer risk and exposure to different chemicals and things in the environment.
In advance of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, that's next month, we're talking to Dr. Leah Dietrich, medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer care and prevention at Gundersen Health System. Dr. Dietrich, the eternal question I think women ask themselves and try to figure out, when should I get scanned? How often? What are some of the basic guidelines that people should know?
So there's been a lot of confusion about that in the recent years because different institutions are putting out different guidelines. And I think that that confusion is a disservice to people. One of the things that is helpful in the new guidelines is it does differentiate women who are at average risk versus women who are at higher risk. But for the average woman, the American Cancer Society recommends annual mammography as an option starting at age 40 and recommended starting at age 45. And so that's probably the simplest, you know, guideline that I can give to women. But the other thing is there's a lot more opportunity to have your risk assessed. Most primary care physicians should be able to assess your breast cancer risk and then tailor your breast cancer screening to that risk. And the other place that it's happening is in the screening mammography area. So there are many places where the technologist will ask you a few questions about your family history and other things that along with breast density is taken into account. And then on your mammogram report, it will actually say what your risk is. And at Gundersen, what we've been doing is then referring women who are at higher risk to our high-risk breast clinic so that we can even talk about other preventative things with them in addition to screening.
Is there enough access to that kind of screening when people need it? We hear about concerns about affordability with many areas of healthcare, and in Wisconsin, geography. Some places might have just more access to nearby screenings. What do you see from where you're working?
Yeah, so I've seen different health systems doing different things. We have a a mobile mammography unit that we bring out to our more rural communities. Other more inner city health systems have programs where they're actually going out into the community and busing people into the facility for mammograms. And we are fortunate that we have the Wisconsin Well Woman program, which will pay for mammograms for patients who qualify due to income status.
Over the years, people may have seen in the news the information about the BRCA gene mutations. Fairly rare, I understand, but when you have these mutations, the risk goes up a lot. What do we know? What do people need to know about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So most breast cancers are not genetic. A small percentage of breast cancers are related to genetic mutations or changes that increase that risk of breast cancer. But for women who do have a BRCA mutation, or even if there is a BRCA mutation in the family, in a first degree relative, we do recommend increased screening that includes MRI in addition to mammogram. And we also recommend MRI for any woman who has a greater than 20% lifetime risk of breast cancer based on family history and other risk factors. So that's why having your risk assessed, if you're able to, by your primary care physician or other ways is a good thing to do.
Is that basic assessment going to test for this BRCA mutation?
Right. It won't test for that, but what we may see is a pattern of a family history that would be suggestive of a mutation, and then that's where that referral would come in to a genetic counselor for genetic testing to find out about whether or not the mutation is present.
There was concern, I know, a couple decades ago I was covering this issue, worry that we could maybe overscreen and overtest and find false positives, and some women would end up getting maybe treatments, biopsies that wouldn't have otherwise been medically necessary. Is this still an argument? Is this still a concern that we have?
I think that's a valid argument. Some types of very early breast cancer, the rates have just skyrocketed because it's the kind of thing that you're only going to find on mammogram. It doesn't usually cause a lump. We're not going to find it any other way. But I think looking at the flip side of that, which sometimes isn't taken into account, is yes, there may be a few more biopsies, but we're getting better and better at, you know, determining who needs a biopsy, a few more diagnoses. But the huge benefit of early detection, again, early detection means better outcomes, more people living related to breast cancer. But in addition to that, it also means a lot of other things. When you're diagnosed with breast cancer at an early stage, that generally means a lesser surgery, radiation, fewer treatments of radiation, maybe no chemotherapy at all. And that translates to less time off work, less disruption of your usual lifestyle.
Dr. Dietrich, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Leah Dietrich, a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer care and prevention at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. She talked to us about breast cancer risk and prevention. Breast Cancer Awareness Month is coming up next month, October.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When we feel unstable or adrift in our daily lives, we may seek out people, places, or activities to help us feel more grounded.
But we could consider the ground itself as a source of steadying comfort.
The rocks, the sand, the sediment, whether we're aware of it or not, have their own stories of highs, lows, change, and resilience through the millennia.
Our next guest has been studying rocks and learning from them since her childhood in rural northwestern Wisconsin. Marcia Bjornerud is the Walter Schober Professor of Environmental Studies and Professor of Geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton. Her new book is called Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. Marcia, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks, Kate. So happy to join you.
In your research field, you write about how it's considered sinful to see rocks and mountains and glaciers as anything other than inert objects, and yet you describe them with words like creative and alert and communicative. How are rocks alive to you?
Well, you're right. It is a bit of a taboo in science to consider entities in nature in any sense animate or sentient, but as a structural geologist, someone who studies mountain building, I understand that rocks really are moving. They're moving across the globe tectonically. They're wrinkling and deforming as continents collide. And so in a very literal sense, rocks are animate. But I would also say that our perception that rocks and landscapes more broadly, or the earth as a whole, are inert entities is a real delusion, a misconception. The earth is noticing what is happening, what we're doing to it. Rocks that formed billions of years ago are drinking in yesterday's rainwater. Everything is in communication in real time. And I think developing this sense of the natural world as, in some sense, sentient is really essential for us both environmentally and, I would argue, psychologically.
When you see rocks as having distinct personalities, does something inside you change? What makes that special when you give them these human qualities?
Well, I think having a sense of familiarity, even kinship with entities in nature, not only living things, but the very rocky substrates below us, can give one a real sense of groundedness, of belonging to this very ancient, amazing earth ecosystem. And for me, there's a real joy in being able to see a rock, recognize it by name, give it a greeting, and read what it's saying.
As you help us understand rocks, we also get glimpses of your own story, your own life, as part of this book. Can you take us back to your childhood as a kid in the 70s in rural Wisconsin, where the sand and the sandstone were part of your origin story?
Yes, and I'm sure many listeners from Wisconsin will recognize their own childhoods. I grew up in a rural part of northwestern Wisconsin where the bedrock is sand. And it's only really in retrospect that I recognize how powerful the bedrock was in shaping the economy and the culture of the place. It's the aquifer. It dictates the soil types and what trees will grow on the land. So I use my own small human story in the book as a kind of portal, inviting people into how one develops a deepening sense of being an earthling.
Well, let's travel to Lake Superior. You say, you know, whose immensity flattens human hierarchies. Why do you consider it to be your center of gravity, as you say?
Well, I mean that in a couple of different ways. It actually has such dense rocks, the basalts that were erupted in this great rifting episode about a billion years ago are very dense. And so there's actually a stronger pull of gravity by a tiny percent when you're close to the lake and those dense rocks. But for me, psychically and even spiritually, that lake, knowing it's there, knowing it's so old, knowing it has many mysteries we still don't understand, is a source of great existential comfort. And I think reminds us to be humble, that nature is so firmly in charge, becomes obvious when you're on the shores of the lake.
When you are on the shores of the lake, what do you pick up and put in your pocket?
Way too many pebbles and cobbles. Yeah, a walk along the beach, a pebble or cobble beach for a geologist can actually be kind of a maddening experience because of this idea that every stone is a little fragment of this greater text. I sometimes liken it to tuning in and out of radio stations. You can sort of hear a few words in a larger conversation, and you're trying to piece together the context. So each stone on the beach has some fragment of a story, and sometimes they're readable, sometimes there's just too little left to really make sense, but they all speak to me.
When you bring your students out into the field, it brings out the best in you. You would say it brings out the best in your students as well, and you take them to the Baraboo Quartzite. Can you talk about those field expeditions and what they're learning?
Yes, teaching in the field is really the optimal way to get people thinking geologically, because they're learning through their feet and their ears and their noses. They're interacting with people in a way that is often much less self-conscious than if they were sitting in a classroom setting. Even in our introductory courses, we make sure that students are getting rich and diverse field experiences. As I mentioned before, Wisconsin is a really geodiverse state. Although we don't have a place like the Grand Canyon where we can see all of the rocks of all the ages that we have, if you go from north to south and east to west, we have a wider range of rock types and ages of rocks than the Grand Canyon. And so this is a wonderful place to teach geology. Here in the eastern part of the state, here in Appleton, we're very close to the Niagara Escarpment. We've got glacial deposits. We don't have to go too far to the north to be in much older Precambrian rocks. So there are many chapters in Wisconsin's history that are available to us if we just know where to look.
Do you have a favorite lesson or a favorite place when you take the students there?
I do. There is this beautiful outcrop that geologists call Point of Rocks. It's right on or off now Highway 12 north of Sauk City. And for many years, it was quite a dangerous place because it's the one place in the road there between Baraboo and Sauk that there was a very sharp bend. The road bent around this promontory of rocks. And about 15 or so years ago, the U.S. Department of Transportation actually had plans to blast that outcrop away, straighten the highway, and make it safer. But geologists from around the country, led by Bob Dott, who was a much beloved member of the faculty at UW-Madison in the geology department, rallied and argued that that was really a natural heritage site and must be preserved. And after several years of negotiations and quite a lot of investment, the highway was rerouted on an overpass, and this beautiful Point of Rocks outcrop is now preserved below the highway and is actually a much better place to take students because trucks are not rushing past constantly. And it's been preserved as a natural heritage site, and it's accessible to anyone who would like to visit.
Marcia, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Marcia Bjornerud is a professor of environmental studies and geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton. Her book is called Turning to Stone: Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks.